to Sleep with Gina Marie. Well, hi, everybody. I'm Gina. Marie is on an adventure. And now you are on an adventure, too. I'm so glad you're here. It is a very special episode. As always, we are all here for classic stories from fabulous authors. And you all are making it easier every day for me to bring you these quality stories. Because not only are you taking the time to like and subscribe, subscriptions are growing, but your wonderful comments are so full of great expertise and great recommendations for future stories. It's awesome. It's a wonderful help. Thank you, thank you. Now, why is this episode so special? Two words. Shirley Jackson. I know. It's been a minute. And don't we love her? The Haunting of Hill House, yes, it is still considered the best ghost story of all time. And because of her demons and ghosts, they were so popular. Her talent wasn't always taken seriously. One critic from long ago called her Virginia Werewolf. It's kind of funny. And yet, did you know the majority of her work is not horror at all, but beautiful, thoughtful prose about, sometimes, unusual circumstances? Oh, and you will hear that in today's episode. Born in 1916 in San Francisco, Ms. Jackson definitely looked at life from a different perspective. Isn't that why we are drawn to her? She always considered herself to be an outsider, and she often wrote about a very cruel, very foolish world. Wonder what she'd think about our world today. It seems logical that she thought of the world in this way because, to me anyway, her mother was completely unafraid of offending her. She constantly reminded Shirley of how disappointed she was in her in a myriad of ways, including unabashedly informing her that she was the product of a failed abortion. Gee, Mom, thanks. There is so much more to learn about this fascinating woman, and some of it is available for you in other Fast Asleep with Gina Marie episodes. So, scroll back when you can, and know that Shirley Jackson was honored with many, many awards. In fact, today's story received a Best Short Story nomination from the Mystery Writers of America, and that was in 1962. It was just 3 years later that Shirley died from a heart condition at age 48. Well, you have certainly waited long enough. Tuck in, everybody, for part one of Shirley Jackson's Louisa, Please Come Home. Louisa, my mother's voice came over the radio. It frightened me badly for a minute. Louisa, she said, please come home. It's been 3 long, long years since we saw you last. Louisa, I promise you that everything will be all right. We all miss you so. We want you back again. Luisa, please come home. Once a year, on the anniversary of the day, I ran away. Each time I heard it, I was frightened again, because between one year and the next, I would forget what my mother's voice sounded like. So soft and yet strange, with that pleading note. I listened every year. I read the stories in the newspapers. Louise Tether vanished 1 year ago, or 2 years ago, or three. I used to wait for the 20th of June as though it were my birthday. I kept all the clippings at first, but secretly. With my picture on all the front pages, I would have looked kind of strange if anyone had seen me cutting it out. Chandler, where I was hiding, was close enough to my old home so that the papers made a big fuss about all of it. But of course, the reason I picked Chandler in the first place was because it was a big enough city for me to hide in. I didn't just up and leave on the spur of the moment, you know. I always knew that I was going to run away, sooner or later. And I had made plans ahead of time for whenever I decided to go. Everything had to go right the first time, because they don't usually give you a second chance on that kind of thing. And anyway, if it had gone wrong, I would have looked like an awful fool, and my sister Carol was never one for letting people forget it when they made fools of themselves. I admit, I planned it for the day before Carol's wedding, on purpose. And for a long time afterward, I used to try and imagine Carol's face when she finally realized that my running away was going to leave her one bridesmaid short. The papers said that the wedding went ahead as scheduled, though, and Carol told one newspaper reporter that her sister Louisa would have wanted it that way. Oh, she would never have meant to spoil my wedding, Carol said, knowing perfectly well that that would be exactly what I'd meant. I'm pretty sure that the first thing Carol did when they knew I was missing was go and count the wedding presents to see what I'd taken with me. Anyway, Carol's wedding may have been fouled up, but my plans went fine. Better, as a matter of fact, than I had ever expected. Everyone was hurrying around the house, putting up flowers and asking each other if the wedding gown had been delivered, and opening up cases of champagne and wondering what they were going to do if it rained and they couldn't use the garden. And I just closed the front door behind me and started off. There was one bad minute when Paul saw me. Paul has always lived next door, and Carol hates him. Worse than she does me. My mother always used to say that every time I did something to make the family ashamed of me, Paul was sure to be in it somewhere. For a long time, they thought he had something to do with my running away, even though he told them over and over again how hard I tried to duck away from him that afternoon when he met me going down the driveway. The papers kept calling him a close friend of the family, which must have overjoyed my mother, and saying that he was being questioned about possible clues to my whereabouts. Of course, he never even knew that I was running away. I told him just what I told my mother before I left, that I was going to get away from all the confusion and excitement for a while. I was going downtown and would probably have a sandwich somewhere for supper and go to a movie. He bothered me for a minute there because, of course, he wanted to come too. I hadn't meant to take the bus right there on the corner, but with Paul tagging after me and wanting me to wait while he got the car so we could drive out and have dinner at the inn, I had to get away fast on the first thing that came along, so I just ran for the bus and left Paul standing there. That was the only part of my plan I had to change. I took the bus all the way downtown. Although my first plan had been to walk, it turned out much better, actually, since it didn't matter at all if anyone saw me on the bus going downtown in my own hometown. And I managed to get an earlier train out. I bought a round-trip ticket. And that was important because it would make them think I was coming back. That was always the way they thought about things. If you did something, you had to have a reason for it. Because my mother and my father and Carol never did anything unless they had a reason for it. So, if I bought a round-trip ticket, the only possible reason would be that I was coming back. Besides, if they thought I was coming back, they wouldn't be frightened so quickly, and I might have more time to hide before they came looking for me. As it happened, Carol found out I was gone that same night when she couldn't sleep and came into my room for some aspirin, so all the time, I had less of a head start than I thought. I knew that they would find out about my buying the ticket. I was not silly enough to suppose that I could steal off and not leave any traces. All my plans were based on the fact that the people who get caught are the ones who attract attention by doing something strange or noticeable. And what I intended all along was to fade into the background where they would never see me. I knew they would find out about the round-trip ticket because it was an odd thing to do. in a town where you've lived all your life, but it was the last unusual thing I did. I thought, when I bought it, that knowing about that round-trip ticket would be some consolation to my mother and father. They would know that no matter how long I stayed away, at least I always had a ticket home. I did keep the return trip ticket quite a while, as a matter of fact. I used to carry it in my wallet as a kind of lucky charm. I followed everything in the papers. Mrs. Peacock and I used to read them at the breakfast table over our second cup of coffee before I went off to work. Now tell me what you think about this girl disappeared over in Rockville, Mrs. Peacock would say to me, and I'd shake my head sorrowfully and say that a girl must be really crazy to leave a handsome, luxurious home like that. Or that I had kind of a notion that maybe she didn't leave at all. Maybe the family had locked her up somewhere because she was a homicidal maniac. Mrs. Peacock always loved anything about homicidal maniacs. And once, I picked up the paper and looked hard at the picture. "Do you think she looks something like me?" I asked Mrs. Peacock. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Once, I picked up the paper and looked hard at the picture. "Do you think she looks something like me?" I asked Mrs. Peacock. And Mrs. Peacock leaned back and looked at me, and then at the picture, and then at me again, and finally, she shook her head and said, "No. If you wore your hair longer and curlier, and your face was maybe a little fuller, there might be a little resemblance. But then, if you looked like a homicidal maniac, I would never have let you in my house." "Well, I think she kind of looks like me," I said. "Oh, you get along to work and stop being vain," Mrs. Peacock told me. Of course, when I got on the train with my round-trip ticket, I had no idea how soon they'd be following me. And I suppose it was just as well, because it might have made me nervous and I might have done something wrong and spoiled everything. I knew that as soon as they gave up the notion that I was coming back to Rockville with my round-trip ticket, they would think of Crane, which is the largest city that train went to, so I only stayed in Crane part of one day. I went to a big department store where they were having a store-wide sale. I figured that would land me in a crowd of shoppers. And I was right. Oh, for a while there was a good chance that I'd never get any farther away from home than the ground floor of that department store in Crane. I had to fight my way through that crowd until I found the counter where they were having a sale of raincoats. And then I had to push and elbow down the counter and finally grab the raincoat I wanted right out of the hands of some old monster who couldn't have used it anyway because she was much too fat. You would have thought she had already paid for it the way she howled. I was smart enough to have the exact change, all $6.89, right in my hand. And I gave it to the sales girl, grabbed the raincoat and the bag she wanted to put it in, and fought my way out again before I got crushed to death. Oh, that raincoat was worth every cent of the $6.89. I wore it right through until winter that year, and not even a button ever came off it. I finally lost it the next spring when I left it somewhere and never got it back. It was tan, and the minute I put it on in the ladies' room of the store, I began thinking of it as my old raincoat, and that was good. I had never before owned a raincoat like that. Oh, and my mother would have fainted dead away. One thing I did that I thought was kind of clever. I left home wearing a light, short coat, almost a jacket. And when I put on the raincoat, of course, I took off my light coat. Then all I had to do was empty the pockets of the light coat into the raincoat and carry the light coat casually over to a counter where they were having a sale of jackets and drop it on the counter as though I'd taken it off a little way to look at it and had decided against it. As far as I ever knew, no one paid the slightest attention to me. And before I left the counter, I saw a woman pick up my jacket and look it over. Oh, I could have told her. She was getting a bargain for $3.98. It made me feel good to know that I had gotten rid of the light coat. My mother picked it out for me. And even though I liked it and it was expensive, it was also recognizable. And I had to change it somehow. I was sure that if I put it in a bag and dropped it into a river or found a garbage truck or something like that, sooner or later it would be found. And even if no one saw me doing it, it would almost certainly be found. And then they would know I had changed my clothes in Crane. No, that light coat never turned up. The last they ever found of me was someone in Rockville who caught a glimpse of me in the train station in Crane. And she recognized me by the light coat. Well, they never found out where I went after that. It was partly luck, and partly my clever planning. 2 or 3 days later, the papers were still reporting that I was in Crane. Yes, people thought they saw me on the streets, and oh, one girl who went into a store to buy a dress, was picked up by the police and held until she could get someone to identify her. They were really looking, but they were looking for Louisa Tether. And I had stopped being Louisa Tether the minute I got rid of that light coat my mother bought me. One thing I was relying on. There must be thousands of girls in the country on any given day who are 19 years old, fair-haired, 5 feet 4 inches tall, and weighing 126 pounds. And if there are thousands of girls like that, well, there must be, among those thousands, a good number who are wearing shapeless tan raincoats. I started counting tan raincoats in Crane after I left the department store, and I passed 4 in one block, so I felt well hidden. And after that, I made myself even more invisible by doing just what I told my mother I was going to do. I stopped in and had a sandwich in a little coffee shop, and then I went to a movie. I wasn't in any hurry at all. And rather than try to find a place to sleep that night, I thought I would sleep on the train. It's funny how no one pays any attention to you at all. There were hundreds of people who saw me that day, and even a sailor who tried to pick me up in the movie. And yet, no one really saw me. If I'd tried to check into a hotel, the desk clerk might have noticed me. Or if I'd tried to get dinner in some fancy restaurant in that cheap raincoat, I would have been conspicuous. But I was doing what any other girl looking like me and dressed like me might be doing that day. The only person who might be apt to remember me would be the man selling tickets in the railroad station. Because, well, girls looking like me in old raincoats didn't buy train tickets, usually, at 11 at night. But I had thought of that, too, of course. I bought a ticket to Amityville, 60 miles away. And what made Amityville a perfectly reasonable disguise is that at Amityville, there is a college. Not a little fancy place like the one I had left so recently with nobody's blessing, but a big, sprawling, friendly affair where my raincoat would look perfectly at home. I told myself I was a student coming back to the college after a weekend at home. We got to Amityville after midnight, but it still didn't look odd when I left the train and went into the station, because while I was in the station having a cup of coffee and killing time, 7 other girls, oh, I counted, wearing raincoats like mine, came in or went out, not seeming to think it the least bit odd to be getting on or off trains at that hour of the night. Some of them had suitcases, and I wished that I had had some way of getting a suitcase in Crane, but it would have made me noticeable in the movie. And college girls going home for weekends often don't bother. They have pajamas and an extra pair of stockings at home, and they drop a toothbrush into one of the pockets of those invaluable raincoats. So, I didn't worry about the suitcase then, although I knew I would need one soon. While I was having my coffee, I made my own mind change. From the idea that I was a college girl, coming back after a weekend at home, to the idea that I was a college girl who was on her way home for a few days. All the time I tried to think as much as possible like what I was pretending to be. And after all, I had been a college girl for a while. I was thinking that even now, that letter was in the mail, traveling as fast as the U.S. government could make it go. Right to my father to tell him why I wasn't a college student anymore. Yes, I suppose that was what finally decided me to run away. The thought of my father, what he would think and say and do when he got that letter from the college. Oh, that was in the paper, too. They decided that the college business was the reason for my running away. But if that had been all, I don't think I would have left. No, I had been wanting to leave for so long, ever since I can remember, making plans till I was sure they were foolproof. And that's the way they turned out to be. Sitting there in the station at Amityville, I tried to think myself into a good reason why I was leaving college to go home on a Monday night late, when I would hardly be going home for the weekend. And as I say, I always tried to think as hard as I could the way that suited whatever I wanted to be, and I liked to have a good reason for what I was doing. Nobody ever asked me, but it was good to know that I could answer them if they did. I finally decided that my sister was getting married the next day, and I was going home at the beginning of the week to be one of her bridesmaids. I thought that was funny. I didn't want to be going home for any sad or frightening reason, like my mother being sick or my father being hurt in a car accident, because, well, I would have to look sad, and that might attract attention. So, I was going home for my sister's wedding. I wandered around the station as though I had nothing to do and just happened to pass the door when another girl was going out. She had on a raincoat, just like mine, and anyone who happened to notice would have thought that it was me who went out. Before I bought my ticket, I went into the ladies' room and got another $20 out of my shoe. Well, I had nearly $300 left of the money I had taken from my father's desk, and I had most of it in my shoes because, well, I honestly couldn't think of another safe place to carry it. All I kept in my pocketbook was just enough for whatever I had to spend next. And it's uncomfortable walking around all day on a wad of bills in your shoe. But they were good, solid shoes, the kind of comfortable old shoes you wear whenever you don't really care how you look, and I had put new shoelaces in them before I left home, so I could tie them good and tight. You can see, I planned pretty carefully, and no little detail got left out. If they'd let me plan my sister's wedding, there would have been a lot less of that running around and screaming and hysterics. I bought a ticket to Chandler, which is the biggest city in this part of the state, and the place I'd been heading for all along. It was a good place to hide, because, well, people from Rockville tended to bypass it, unless they had some special reason for going there. See, if they couldn't find the doctors or orthodontists or psychoanalysts or dress material they wanted in Rockville or Crane, they went directly to one of the really big cities, well, like the state capital. Chandler was big enough to hide in, but not big enough to look like a metropolis to people from Rockville. The ticket seller in the Amityville station must have seen a good many college girls buying tickets for Chandler at all hours of the day or night, because he took my money and shoved the ticket at me without even looking up. Funny. They must have come looking for me and Chandler at some time or other, because, well, it's not likely that they would have neglected any possible place I might be. But maybe Rockville people never seriously believed that anyone would go to Chandler from choice, because I never felt for a minute that anyone was looking for me there. Oh, my picture was in the Chandler papers, of course, but as far as I ever knew, no one ever looked at me twice. And I got up every morning and went to work and went shopping in the stores and went to movies with Mrs. Peacock and went out to the beach all that the summer without ever being afraid of being recognized. I behaved just like everyone else and dressed just like everyone else, and even thought just like everyone else. And the only person I ever saw from Rockville in 3 years was a friend of my mother's. And I knew she only came to Chandler to get her poodle bred at the kennels there. She didn't look as if she was in a state to recognize anybody but another poodle fancier anyway. And all I had to do was step into a doorway as she went by. And she never looked at me. Two other college girls got on the train to Chandler when I did. Maybe both of them were going home for their sisters' weddings. Neither of them was wearing a tan raincoat, but one of them had on an old blue jacket that gave the same general effect. I fell asleep as soon as the train started. And once I woke up, and for a minute I wondered where I was. And then I realized that I was doing it. I was actually carrying out my careful plan and had gotten better than halfway with it. And I almost laughed right there in the train, with everyone asleep around me. And then I went back to sleep and didn't wake up until we got into Chandler about 7 in the morning. So there I was. I had left home just after lunch the day before. And now, at 7 in the morning of my sister's wedding day, I was so far away in every sense that I knew they would never find me. And I had all day to get myself settled in Chandler, so I started off by having breakfast in a restaurant near the station, and then went off to find a place to live and a job. The first thing I did was buy a suitcase, and it's funny how people don't really notice if you're buying a suitcase near a railroad station. Suitcases look natural near railroad stations. And I picked out one of those stores that sell a little bit of everything and bought a cheap suitcase and a pair of stockings and some handkerchiefs and a little traveling clock. And I put everything into the suitcase and carried that. Nothing is hard to do, unless you get upset or excited about it. Later on, when Mrs. Peacock and I used to read in the papers about my disappearing, I asked her once if she thought that Louisa Tether had gotten as far as Chandler. And she didn't. Well, they're saying now she was kidnapped, Mrs. Peacock told me. And that's what I think happened. Kidnapped and murdered. They do terrible things to young girls they kidnap. Huh. But you know, the papers say there wasn't any ransom note. Yeah, that's what they say. Mrs. Peacock shook her head at me. How do we know what the family is keeping secret? Or if she was kidnapped by a homicidal maniac, well, why should he send a ransom note? Introduction information for this episode is from The Haunted Mind of Shirley Jackson by Zoe Heller for The New Yorker. Music for this episode is Sea of Tranquility and Trieste, both by Julius Aston. Autumn in Bruges by Randy Oppenheim. Reflections and Nightfall by Eamon Watt. And of course, you can reach me at fastasleepwithginamarie44@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and we're having an awful lot of fun on TikTok these days. Check us out. Please keep us here for you with your wonderful comments, your likes, and those subscriptions. Thank you for listening. We'll be with you next week for the conclusion of Shirley Jackson's Louisa, Please Come Home. Keyword: homicidal. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.